This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Okay, ready?
Think what you know, and it's about a time when you get yourself in. We are... I wanna know some of the things she's done. I think about everyone you need. I'm holding it, things are moving real now. I have you seen you wanting you. Hey.
It's a ratio. Okay, though. It's a ratio. Okay, though.
That might be the best question I've ever been asked.
You're a phenomenal person. I mean, you legendary.
I am a fan of you, my brother.
We've had a lot of incredible musicians on this show, which is a joy to me because I love talking to musicians and hearing about people who have that part of their brain just so deeply developed. So let's do a special episode. We haven't done this before, but we're very excited about this, where we take pieces that great musicians who've been on this show talked about and build it into a single episode where we are talking about big ideas around how to be a great musician. So let's get into a chorus of amazing musicians who've been on this show talking about music for Torre Show.
This week on Torre Show, we're talking to Maxwell.
I remember trying to set up my MIDI situation, which I'm sure musicians out there know and remember the time of Simpty and MIDI. And I remember being so depressed because I couldn't get it to work. And I was depressed for 24 hours. I mean, I just threw my hands up and then went to sleep. And I just was like, I can't believe I can't put this together. And that's how I knew I cared. And that's pretty much when you know that you are onto something, is when it can frustrate you so much just in the process of trying to get it. But for just the execution part, not the result part, not the what's going to happen part, will I have a number one record part? No, you just want to execute. Like, you know, I'm sure when you're writing, it's probably the same thing. You just want to execute it. You know, whether you turn up on a lot of pages or people start talking about the story, that's great. That's fine. And that's an added plus. But just to be able to execute what you're trying to do was all I cared about. And that's all I still care about, is execution.
The studio, then, is the fun part for you. You keep saying, like, I'm not about the fame. I'm about the studio and executing it. I love making the music.
Yeah, I love making the music. I can say that the pure joy for me is being done with the music and knowing it and performing it, because then it's done. But the actual constructing of the song and making sure that every note is right and that every word that's chosen, that can be laborious. It can be very arduous for me. And I feel like, am I making the right choice? Am I using the right? So it was actually a really good thing that when Urban Hang Suite came out, that it was shelved for a year. So I had a year with a finished record to really look at what it was and make the right decisions about sequencing as everybody else was done and as the record label was figuring out where to fit me in. You know,
well, take me inside your music making process. How does it go? What do you do?
I mean, it can start in the shower. I mean, it can start with any conversation. Working with Hot, sometimes tracks, he comes up with some tracks and, you know, I may add things to the track, but songs happen fast. I mean, I don't like to listen to anything too long. It's just like the last album, we had two cuts that I did with Stuart Matthewman. I never heard anything. They were all one take, never written down. I'm not trying to be the new Jay-Z out here. I'm just saying I found in my as I've grown older, that the first try is the best. It's God really speaking.
Really? First take, usually.
It can be like that simple. But, you know, but then, the, you know, you have to kind of find the words and the mumbled kind of melody moments, and then find the structure within some of the chord progressions so that it makes sense in terms of a production.
I mean, you're very much a, or are you a very feel person? Like, when it feels right, I'll do it, rather than I write from 10 to 12 or whatever.
Yeah, I'm a feel person. I mean, for me, if it's about going through stuff, I'm trying to, you know, change my process so it's not about coming from sorrow and pain, but that I can kind of be a happy person and still draw from experiences of disillusionment, experiences of disappointment, instead of having to be in constant situations where I'm disappointed so that I can then be of use creatively to the world. I don't want to have a complex to create. You know?
What, wait,
does that make sense?
Yes, but let's talk about that. That historically you have needed a complex to create. What do you mean?
I mean just, you know, my life in itself, you know, just the idea of having to go out here and, you know, put myself in a position where I know that I'll be judged. I'll be judged, criticized, observed. It's very conditional to put yourself in this position. And then when you actually do something of substance, then you're judged based on the last great thing, and then onward and onward and onward, and it never stops. And it's all generational. So, you know, I remember being away for a long time on the scene, and you know, just reading things about my relevancy and whether or not I would be relevant. And this was like in 2007. And then Pretty Wings comes out. And then everyone's cool with you, you know? And then now that's the bar that you have to sort of work from. Yeah. So it's, people don't really understand that. I mean, I don't work with like a big factory of songwriters. It's pretty much the same people. And then I step out and maybe I work with, you know, Alicia, who, you know, I knew it when she was 16, you know, and she was at Columbia. Alicia Keys, sorry for everyone who's out there who doesn't. I'm sure you guys know who she is. And then there's, of course, you know, working with R. Kelly, who, you know, I mean, he was such a huge movement in the 90s. I never got to meet him, even though I did a song, you know, with him, sort of, you know. And that was actually not a bad thing, because I had a little bit more control over the music and the way that Fortunate came together, because he was busy, you know, writing other hits for
other people.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the anxiety that you talk about, you know, being judged by other people and sort of things, a lot of artists go through that. And for some folks, it's debilitating and they don't create, or they don't create to their potential. You get those feelings. Somehow you deal with it and you still get to your highest potential. So how do you combat those feelings and get to your greatest ability?
Well, I feel for me, you know, putting as much emphasis on the music as possible and de-emphasizing who I am. You know, I obviously, we're here to do an interview and find out all these details, but the more I can divorce myself from you being concerned about where I'm from, all the, like, who I'm, like, all that stuff that everyone wants to know, which has become a very prevalent part of promoting an artist now, where people are pretty much reality shows, which is fine. This is the social media era. You know, it's the era of, you know, knowing people's business. I mean, I remember a time where I didn't know what my greatest people that I didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
All I know is that that album came and, you know, there was a 2-year break or a 3 or 4 year break, and we didn't know anything.
Right.
And all we had was those songs.
Right.
Now it's part of the promotion package is, you know, devising some scheme to create some sort of publicity stunt to
dating.
Get people interested into getting involved with you. And then, oh yeah, the music too. For me, I believe that, you know, when I look at someone like Sade, it's been, what, 7 years since she put out Soldier of Love. We don't know nothing.
Nothing.
And that's a special thing. I hope we can go back to a place where we could just leave people alone and let them be creative people instead of trying to get interested in them to then dissect them, destroy them, and then move on.
Toni Braxton on Touré Show.
I mean, you are one of the deepest sounding of the superstar females, right? Of your era. But anyway, right?
That's,
I mean,
true.
It's a, so who are you? Who is an influence? Who is an inspiration to you as a deeper sounding woman?
This is going to sound crazy. Everyone knows it's Anita Baker, but it was also Michael McDonald.
Okay, tell me about Anita Baker and tell me about Michael
McDonald. I know, very eclectic group. Anita Baker, she's a contralto like myself.
She's deeper than you, right?
I'm probably a little deeper than her.
Really? Okay.
A little deeper, but we're both contraltos. But she could probably reach the same notes that I can, probably.
Okay.
And she was the only person who was out at the time to sound like me. You had Whitney, whom I love, all these soprano singers, that Mariah, but Anita Baker had that. You bring me joy when... It was very low and husky. And
yeah.
She sounded like me, so I gravitated to her immediately.
And Michael McDonald?
Well, Michael McDonald, because you can't understand anything he says like myself. And but he had, his voice sounds like it's in a compressor.
What was his big hit?
Keep forgetting, baby. That song, keep forgetting, not in love anymore. That song.
Yes, yes.
Keep forgetting.
Warren
yes,
G. Yes.
But yeah, our generation, yeah.
Yes. I was thinking about a previous sale, an earlier thing. Warren
yes.
G. Sale, but yes.
Warren G.
Yes. So, was Luther at all?
Luther was in there, but he was a tenor. But I could sing him, anything he sung, but he had a little bit of height on me, a little bit of that upper range.
Can you sing soprano?
On Break My Heart, that one note is soprano. Probably
okay.
Second, but... The tone of my voice makes you think it's a tenor.
So you could do that, but contralto is what you are naturally.
It's contralto because you're arranged. You're comfortable here. This is where you're home, but you can go up and you can go down, but here's where you sleep.
Mm-hmm,
so I can do some things that's high, especially in my Foss, I could do anything.
In your what?
Foss, my falsetto.
So, I mean, was there an effort to learn how to control your voice, like to find that home and to find it in a deeper place than other women who you're listening to were finding theirs?
It was always there, but Ellie and Babyface helped me control it to the upper range.
Okay.
They helped
what does
me
that
do
mean?
That. Like if I was singing songs, they would make the key almost too high to push me to get comfortable with the higher range.
Uh-huh. So what did that do?
It's almost like exercising a muscle, and you take it and you overexpand it so it gets comfortable being used to that capacity. So they would have me sing songs higher than you would expect for me to sing, which were a little uncomfortable at first. And then I got comfortable with singing a little higher than I felt comfortable. They took me out of my comfort zone.
So then that made it easier to be.
Made it easier for me to. My songs are a lot higher than people think, though. But you hear the tone and the texture and you think they're lower, but they're not. They're not low.
They're not.
Not really, no.
So at your level,
yeah.
What does a singer do just to prepare? What does practice look like?
You know, I really don't warm up before a show. When I did Broadway, I did because that was a different type of singing. So if I'm singing Belle, I can't sing in this husky Tony voice. So I had to get comfortable with singing, "There goes the baker with his tray like always, the same old bread and rolls to sell." I had to get comfortable singing and a Disney voice. So I had to warm up for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had to.
But so for the stage, for a concert,
no,
you don't warm
never,
up?
Never, ever. But that comes from church. We're going to have an A and B selection by Tony. You don't get a chance to warm up. You just have to sing.
You just go out and
I just sing.
Just,
yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Do you not talk before you go out?
If I'm getting hoarse, I don't speak before shows.
But most of the time, that's not a problem.
But most of the time, no, not really.
Do you warm up before the studio?
Nope. I just go in singing.
Is there a time when you're doing scales or practicing in some way?
Nope. I don't know what that is.
So I'm wondering, everybody has that 10,000 hours, right, that they spend like practicing before they get to be a master.
I probably had 30,000.
So where did you spend that? Like, what were you doing? Was that all in church?
Most of it was in church, and we practiced a lot, like the Jacksons practice. You see the movie?
Yeah, of course.
We were like that, like while our friends were out at the park or playing, we were home rehearsing all the time, hours a day.
From a young age.
From a young age. Hours. Gosh, maybe to that degree by the time I was 10.
So from 10.
From 10 on. I spent more than 10,000 hours, absolutely.
At home, just singing with your sisters.
All the time. And they were young. They were babies. So if I was 10, Tamar was a newborn. But we had a group before Tamar was born, even.
Was this directed by you or your mom?
My mom's a singer. She sung opera. So she helped foster us in the singing world.
So was she constantly saying, all right, girls, come on, let's sing.
No doubt.
Some.
If we sing the wrong note, we would get punished. No, I'm not joking. Just like we
punished
call,
in what way?
Like really punished. Couldn't watch television. You can't go outside. My mom, her last name's Jackson, her maiden name. And she is Joe Jackson's first cousin because my mom is no joke.
Well, did you get hit?
We would get spanking sometimes if we sung the wrong note.
You got spankings for singing
absolutely.
The wrong note?
Absolutely. Just like the Jacksons. There's no mystery that my family and I can sing.
Wait, tell me about a time when you sung the wrong note and you got hit.
Got a few of them. let's say we were singing, let's say harmonizing, and my mom told us to practice the day before. So we'd be ready to sing the next day. And say she saw me on the phone. And I wasn't practicing, so I sung my note and I sung it wrong. I was like, I told you, and you might get a smack on my arm or whatever. You weren't practicing. You were on the phone. No phone for you for the next month. It was like long punishments.
For singing the wrong
note. Long punishments, just like athletes when they were playing sports and their parents were like, you know, managing them or I should say their trainer. It's the same exact thing.
Well, it sounds like James Brown, right? Finding people for missing a note or being late coming in. Or
yeah.
Did that intensity make you better or did it make you retreat?
It makes you better because you don't want to get in trouble. And then you want to please your parents too at the same time.
Let's talk about Breathe Again because I think that is my favorite of your songs. And it's your favorite of
it's
your
my favorite
songs?
Song to
really?
It's my favorite to perform. Yeah.
I mean, it's deep, it's heavy. And I think the moment that like the chorus is not the big moment for me. It's the moment after the chorus, and I can't stop thinking about. But just that is the hook that crushes me, and the way you do that line.
Thank you.
Where were you when you made that record?
I was in Atlanta at Doppler Studio. I sung it three times. The first time Daryl Simmons produced it. The first time Daryl. The second was Babyface, and the last time was L.A. Because Daryl had me sing it a little differently because the song was for TLC.
Right.
At first it was, and I can't stop thinking about the way then just the babe for Tion. That's how it was at first. So Daryl had me sing it like that at first.
Uh-huh.
And then Babyface said, let me have her sing it again. So he had me sing it differently. And then by the time it got to LA, he said, I need her to sing it how she would sing it.
Mm-hmm.
And once I sung it my way, he was like, that's what I'm talking about.
When you say three times, like you sang it straight through?
One day I did it with Daryl. A week later I did it with Babyface.
Straight
maybe.
Through.
Yeah, I sing maybe four or five takes and I'm done on a song, some songs. And then maybe a month later, I did it with L.A. because he heard it. It's like, we can make it better. I want her to sing it her way. Just sing it and we'll see what happens.
Uh-huh.
So I had a lot of creative freedom as a new artist.
So what we heard is that third take with L.A.
That third take with L.A.
And getting to that money line, and I can't stop thinking about, like, how did you get the tone and everything right? You're kind of in the back of your mouth.
It sounds
there,
like
right?
I'm in the back of my throat, but it's just the way my voice sounds.
Mm.
It was just, I heard the song. I thought it was a beautiful song. I begged for it. They said, well, it's not your song. Like, please give me that song. So I was in love with the song when I first heard it in demo form because I had an idea how I was going to perform it.
Wait, so you're coming from where? Deep in your chest when you sing?
When I sing from here. I don't sing from here.
From the chest.
But sometimes it sounds like I'm from here. Maybe because there's so many marbles in my mouth. Like I remember Ellie and Kenny would say, okay, the first song I ever sung, Give You My Heart with Babyface. Remember that song from the Boomerang soundtrack? So I was singing it. And I'll give you my heart. No, Babyface. Okay, give us a second. So I'm watching through the big mirror, big glass. And then it's, okay, Tony, we need you to sing that again. But we can't understand what you're singing. What are you saying? Okay, can you give us some conjunctions and or give us something so we can understand it? But be you. Of course, that put pressure on me. So I managed to get a few conjunctions so you could understand some of the lyrics in between. But they kind of helped me get my sound, because then after that, I started to enunciate every word. I said, no, don't do that. Still be you. Just give us a few things in there, like a noun or two. And that's how I kind of got my
be
sound.
Be you, but be different.
Be you, but be somebody else. Kind of, yeah.
When I was growing up, it meant so much to hear black voices like James Baldwin and Toni Morrison talk about the black experience, because black stories matter. The next generation of influential black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be black today. From The Wire to Bobby Shmurda, from Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range on Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives have not usually been centered in the telling of American stories. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Turn on NPR today and hear real Black stories, because stories should never be told about us without us being in them. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel about a young black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young black man in America. Colm McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book, available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First.
Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
Big Daddy Kane is one of the greatest MCs of all time.
I went out and bought Marvin Gaye, Barry White, and James Brown VHSs. And I really studied them and tried to incorporate a lot of their elements into my stage show.
Well, what did you, I mean, can you talk about what elements from them that you really grabbed on and used?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Marvin just had a certain swagger on stage. You know, he just had a certain coolness and he just moved gracefully. You know, like normally, you know, you see a hip hop dude, you know, it's, you know, that's the energy. That's what we do, you know. But I tried to have that, you know, that Marvin swagger, that graceness, you know, just let it flow. You know, that's something that I really picked up for him. And then performance through Smooth Operator, I completely stole his Let's Get It On move, you know? Yeah.
You I know. Mean, the depth and quality of your voice, it really overpowers the records. You know, as soon as you start talking, you're completely focused on that Kane sound. Which reminds me of Barry White and how you just love, you could listen to both you guys, just listen to you read the phone book.
Well, I mean, I was tuned into Barry's style before my voice changed. My voice didn't really change until I think I was 20. Because my voice was a lot higher. If you listen to the first album, I think it changed like right after the release of the second album. That's when my voice like really started changing. With Barry, you know, he was just cool, you know, and he had a certain way of, you know, connecting with people in the crowd. It could be just one little small thing, you know, just pointing to them or just saying something to them. You know, he could have, you know, like, you know, he could have been singing the regular words of the song right there, right there. And then pointing to someone in the crowd. Hey there. You know what I'm saying? Like stuff like that, you know, just where, you know, you got them involved, you know?
Were there things that you took from them that you brought to the records, like just in the studio and in the writing?
Well, writing wise, I mean, I was really like a student of Grandmaster Caz from the Cold Crush Brothers and Smokey Robinson, you know. I like listening to the pioneers from the late 70s. Well, I mean, you know, they early 70s. I mean, when I heard them, it was late 70s when I heard them, you know. Like the Kumo D, Grandmaster Caz, Melly Mel, you know, listening to those guys, it was like, you know, they were like the top three. And Caz just had this certain swagger, just remind you of that Brooklyn barbershop talk, yeah. Pool hall talk, you know, slick talk and stuff. And I just really admired dude. So I learned a lot from listening to Caz. And as far as putting words together and clever thinking, I learned a lot from Smokey Robinson and Chris Christopherson.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I liked him in the 70s. I mean, your pen was more complex than anybody before you. Like, you were in an era of, like, you and Rakim, who, like, you know, and Kool G Rap, who advanced the level of complexity to a level that we had not seen before. What were you trying to do as a writer? Because you're just bringing in a whole different level of sonic complexity than we had ever had.
I mean, honestly, just introduce the world to me, you know, like for real, really just introduce the world to me, just open my mind, you know, to them, you know, I grew up as a fan of hip hop, you know, since probably like 75, you know, when Cats was at the age of one, my life begun, you know, those type of rhymes, you know, and to see what it became, thanks to Melly Mel, where brothers started using their own voice and the lyrical content really, you know, stepped it up. You know, I mean, just seeing that, I mean, it was like just monumental to me. So, I mean, I felt like I wanted to, you know, really bring those type of dynamics to the game, you know, and, just really open my mind up to people so they can see the way I think, you know?
Were you a big reader as a kid? Is that, I mean, like, cause you had the vocab and the way of putting it together in a complex way. And, were you a big reader or?
Yeah, I definitely was. But in school, you know, I was At the time, I was, you know, real good in English as well. So, you know, there was just something that I thought was just important. And especially like, you know, when you're at a park jam and in Brooklyn back in the 70s, you know, you see them, they throw on Love Is the Message or they throw on Bra and you see the mic line form and cats getting the mic line to rhyme. And everybody get up there and you see they cuffing the mic and they, you know, like, Gucci, and you can't really hear them, you know, because they cuffing the mic like this, you know. And you know, a lot of cats, you know, like, you know, the weed smokers and the 40-ounce drinkers, you know, they you know, they might be a tad bit slurred, so you can't really understand them. So that was something that was very important to me, because, you know, just watching like R&B vocalists, it was like clarity was just, you know, so I've really, really, that meant something to me. I felt like that was so important, you know. And then also, you know, Marvin Gaye had a habit of holding the mic down here. He never really had it up here. His mic would be down here, you know. So that was just something that was just real important to me through my career.
Okay, so what do you think is your strength as an MC? What is
lyrics.
The...
Just lyrics, writing lyrics.
Verses.
Yeah. That's something that, you know, I can do, you know, in my sleep, man, because the way my mind thinks, because I'm always all over the place. So therefore, I can put something together that'll be incredible for me. I can put something together that'll be incredible for you, you know. I mean, if I listen to your style, you know, I can come up with something in your style, you know. I mean, you know, so I mean, yeah, that's my thing.
I mean, your lyrics are you know, top rate, but sometimes it's just the way that you spit the words, the rhythm in between the beat that makes it so fly. And so I wonder just about developing that sense of rhythm within the beat that can make almost average words sound fly as hell just because of the way you dropped them in between the beat or on the beat or behind the beat or whatever you were choosing.
I mean, I think that's just a Brooklyn thing, man, for real. I mean, I think that, you know, I think Brooklyn MCs just know how to embrace a beat like no other. Like they get on some real Ella Fitzgerald type of thing, and they just fall into it like an instrument, you know? I mean, you look at Fabulous, Jay-Z, Biggie, and you could even go prior to me. You look at Ecstasy from Houdini, rest in peace. You look at Disco Richie from Divine Sounds, even Jimmy Spicer, when everybody else, you know, in, you know, in the early years, everybody was all like, you know, come on, to the blade. You know, Jimmy Spicer, he was doing that too, but he still break away with some, this DJ, he gets down mixing records while he go around. You know, that's that Brooklyn thing, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, just a thing, we just become an instrument, you know, on the track.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I love about MCing is when you become that instrument within the track. You're a drum within the track. And sometimes my first or second time through listening to an MC's record, you're not really getting all the words, but you're hearing the rhythmic relationship to the track and the way you are percussive within the track. And that will like draw you in to where I'm like, okay, I want to learn and listen to all these words because the way that he's spitting it is so dope.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that I actually learned a little later, exactly how to make it work. I mean, it's something that came natural, but I learned how to really control it in the early 90s after working with Quincy Jones, you know, like when he was telling me like a lot of jazz vocalists would fall into the track and follow the piano. And he was saying how Ella Fitzgerald, like with her, she used to try to her scatting thing, she would try to like do it like a horn. Like she was like, her movement was like a horn section, you know?
Right.
So I was like, So, I mean, that's something that, you know, like when I'm writing, if I want to change up the flow, I might, you know, hum it out in a horn fashion before I put it in words, you know?
Morris Day was one of Prince's best friends from back when they were teenagers. I want to jump into what to me is one of the greatest moments of the 80s, which is the making of Jungle Love, because it is an amazing record. And there's just so much energy and funk, and it's a really special record. And I imagine it's not the kind of thing you just roll into the studio and make and leave. Like, you got to, like, you know, deal with that and get the vibe and get the ad-libs right and just get, you know, get the whole thing. So take me to, you know, tell me the story of recording Jungle Love.
Well, Jungle Love kind of came together in stages. You know, everybody in our camp would, from time to time, submit grooves to Prince. And Jesse Johnson sent him this bass line, and he dug it. So the next thing you know, we're, you know, in there listening to it, and, you know, he comes up with the whole Jungle Love concept, and we just hopped in the studio, man, and started creating, you know?
But I mean, like, the energy on that, I mean, like, I know that it was, was it special in the studio when you were making that?
It was. You know, we always, you know, whatever energy we had going, you know, and it was just one of those kind of days where, you know, we were like on a creative high, everybody was upbeat and, you know, feeling the track, and it just kind of came together like that. You know, it was just one of the magical moments.
So but you were not yet a front man. You weren't a front man yet.
Not at all. Not at all. Just stand there and sing the song. So I said, I don't even know what I would do as a lead singer of a band. And he said, just put your hand in your pocket and be cool. And that's what I did. If you watch the cool video, my right hand does not come out of my pocket the whole song. So after we started going on tour, you know, I started adding to my repertoire, and I started doing a little extra here and there, and it just kind of came together.
Because you become one of the great frontmen of the decade, super suave, alpha, pimply, you know, persona, ego. I mean, like, you know, by the time we get to Purple Rain, you know, we cannot take our eyes off of Morris Day. So, I mean, it really came together.
Yeah, it did. And, you know, that was just from years of boot camp. By the time we got to 84, when the movie came out, since we're assigned to Prince's production company, and once we started going on tour with him, first of all, the rehearsals were rigorous. We would rehearse around the clock. And then go out and do the shows, and we do months at a time, and come back and rehearse some more. And each time we went out, every time I stepped on stage, I realized something different in myself and how to, you know, how I wanted to convey myself and come across as an artist, you know. And I just kept adding, and you know, and you do little things and people like it, and you put that in the spank bank and save it for later and do it again, you know?
Hmm. When did the Jerome part arise of, you know, your sideman is your butler and he comes out on stage with a mirror and you comb your hair in the middle of the groove? And like when did, and like, nobody, I never seen anything like that. When did that start?
That kind of happened, you know, we were at rehearsal and we were rehearsing to go back out on tour. We'd already been out and Jerome wasn't in the band. He was a valet for real. He used to get the band's bags and set them out and make sure the dry cleaning and all of that. That was his gig. And so we're at rehearsal at this little raggedy rehearsal studio in Southside, Minneapolis. And I get to the part in the song where I say, somebody bring me a mirror. And Jerome jumps up, he starts looking around, and he runs and grabs this mirror off the wall and brings it up to me and holds it up in front of me. And it was just one of them moments. We all kind of stopped and started looking at each other. We were like, this is going to be a part of the show. And so Jerome was in he was in from that moment.
Just ingenuity.
Timing.
You know, a lot of people, a lot of people have talked about how the Morris Day character and the time was another way of Prince getting out a certain side of him that was too much. It was too street. It was too, you know, like nigga. It was too pimply for what he was trying to do in his music. How much of it is that? How much of that stew that is you, the Morris Day and the time, how much of it is Prince saying, hey, I want y'all to be this, and how much of it is you saying, like, I want to be this?
Well, when it started, it was a lot of an alter ego situation for Prince, because he had some songs already laying around. Get It Up was one of them, and you know, I just thought that when I heard that, it was so funky. It was, you know, I said, we got to do that song on the record. So early on, there were songs that he had cut for himself and set aside that we ended up using. And so it started out being an alter ego situation for him. And then it turned out to be a Frankenstein monster situation for him because, you know, once he got us up and going, then, you know, we started growing, you know, as a band and as performers and even as musicians, because we were now putting in more rehearsal time than we had ever. So it started out alter ego, and then it turned into a competition.
What do you mean a competition between the time and the revolution?
Absolutely, because when we would go out, you know, we had 30 minutes to speak our piece on stage. You know, do what you're going to do. You got 30 minutes. And we start putting together these super tight sets. And then, you know, a couple of times people came up after the show and they'd be like, man, y'all kicked Prince's ass tonight. And, you know, that started to happen a little more often than he was comfortable with. So that's when that's when the competition started to really kick in.
Did you? So when you started to really beat him more than a little bit, how did he respond?
Well, he started changing up his set. You know, just in a competitive way. You know, he started trying to figure it out. And don't get me wrong. You know, Prince. You know, I don't have to say, you know, was an awesome performer. So there was nights where he would just step off in our ass too. So it was a give and take, but I just think it helped us. Yeah, it helped us all be better.
India Ari is an amazing, legendary modern singer. What do you love about singing?
That's a good question. What do I love about singing? So I have to say, to answer this, I have to say something that I wish I always wished I could do, which is dance. Because when I see people dance, I always think that must feel awesome to be able to like feel like you're flying like that, or you know, whatever it feels like when you can really dance like that, when people can really dance, like they look light on their feet, they look like they're flying or something. And for me, singing is kind of like that. Like you love the sound of a trumpet or the sound of a certain instrument, or even the sound of a certain bird or the wind or the ocean. Like you like those sounds. It's really a special feeling in your body to be able to make a sound from your body that you think is beautiful. And I never think of it like, dang, I can sing. Oh, I'd be singing. I don't think of it like that. I just think that feels good and it feels right. Ever since I was very young and I had very strong likes and dislikes with people's voices and the way that they sang, because sometimes people are not like Patti LaBelle all up and down the scale to be great singers. There's just something that you just feel from people. And I've had that sense about people since I was very young. Like, for example, Sade, she sings kind of right here, but she makes you feel a lot. And I know that there's something about that person when they have that capacity. And so I just like being able to make it beautiful. Me, a sound that is authentic for my body. And for the last 20 years, I had a single-minded focus about what I wanted to achieve because of feeling like I'm where I'm supposed to be. Make music is what I do. I'm not trying to be something I'm not. I didn't want to just be famous. I didn't want people to just look at me. So I got to find something to do while they're looking at me. I am a musician. I'm a singer. I had things that I needed to say for my well-being, things I needed to say. And the honor of having an audience there that wants to listen is the thing that my mother made sure I was not robbed of. And so even when I learned the days of the week in preschool, my mother wrote a song called India's Song to teach me the days of the week.
What was the song?
And so it goes Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I am 1 week older, starting new on Monday. When I get home from my school, I will go to play. Starting each and every morning, it's a brand new day. And we would sing it every day going to school. That's how I learned my days of the week. And so my mom has a lot to do with everything that I've been able to accomplish. And also, I think it's what has been important to my image. Every artist has to have an image for people to hold on to. You know, it's a part of your aesthetic and part of your success. And being able to have a look that was all my own. Like when people say like that NDRE look, because for a few years there, I thought everybody liked what I like. I didn't realize they were dressing like me for a little era. And that look, like with no black, full color, flower, like the things I was wearing and all that stuff, was because my mom was like, what do you want? I literally had like a personal designer like Prince. And I used to joke, I have a personal designer like Prince. And I'm like, no, I actually have a personal designer like Prince. And it's my mom. So there's like love sewn into my mother could make the biggest gown overnight because she was like, my daughter needs it. And she would just do it all the time. And so I'm here because she taught me in explicit and non-explicit and all the other ways that I could be here.
Do you have perfect pitch?
Probably not. I mean, I think I sing on key, but as far as like somebody play a note and I'll go, oh, that's a E. I don't think I have that. No, I might have never thought about it.
But you always knew that you were better than everybody around you.
It wasn't like I just know. It was like we would sing in the hall. Again, I was like very shy, very to myself. I was the weird girl in school. Always I had different clothes and different hairs. So I was like always off to myself. And I would hear girls in the hallway who had like the real fiery personalities and they'd be singing in the hallway and singing. And I remember I'd listen to them and be like, what are they doing? What is she doing? You know? Then I would play around like, cause what any singer that I know, when you walk into a room that has great acoustics, you automatically start singing. You just, cause the acoustics are nice in there. And I would do something like that in gym class or something. And all the girls would be like, that weird girl can sing. Like, I was like, it was like that. And I just never sang around anyone. I didn't talk about singing. I kept it to myself, but I knew that I could do something they couldn't do.
Tell me about writing a song. How do you write a song?
I don't know. Second, I usually start with something that I want to say. But also third, I start with a feeling inside. Like if I hear chords that give me a certain feeling, then I try to find words that match the feeling. But I don't know how to, I feel like I would be more prolific if I had a system where I would go, this is what I do. It's funny, you didn't ask me this, but there is one song, there are a couple, like I said, there are a couple times when I had a melody and put lyrics in, and there's one song in particular called Good Morning. Like I had the melody and put the words in, and that ended up being one of my most dynamic songs production-wise. Like there's a string break and the strings are dissonant and it's like, and it goes like in all these places. Anything could happen.
How do you combine meditation and songwriting?
I think when we were talking about meditation and sports, that at its simplest, at its foundation, meditation is a way to calm your nervous system. So when you do that before you dive into your craft, it gives you a space where you're allowing the art to emerge instead of trying to push it out. You don't try to make songs when you're relaxed. You allow it to emerge. And that, if there is anything that is a formula for me, it's that. When I don't meditate first, it just doesn't work. But I had to figure that out. Like, it just kind of figured out over the years. Nobody taught me that. I just started doing it somehow. I started realizing I was doing it and realizing what happened when I didn't do it. So even when Stevie asked me to write A Time to Love, I was very nervous because of Stevie Wonder and I wanted it to be great. And I remember going into meditation and like I said a prayer and I went to meditation and I wrote the song and it all came out really easy. But it wasn't that moment where I was like, that's how you do that. It wasn't like that, but just over the years, I would do it again. Sometimes I didn't, sometimes I did. And I would say over the last 8 years, it's become a practice, like a formula, and it never fails me. I never get writer's block when I do it that way. Never. It just works.
Last thing. What is your superpower? What is the thing that you do better than other people that has led to all of your success?
I think that I'm an incredible genius. No. That'd be ridiculous if I said that. I think, how do I say that? I think that I am a courageous feeler. I'm willing to feel my feelings and feel things. I'm willing to feel things that hurt. I'm willing to feel my feelings. And I think that gives me the gift of being able to convey emotion in a song in a way that not everyone can. And I think the emotional connection to my music is what my true, the true lovers of my music connect to. It's not because they like my style or that I'm the greatest singer. I think it's the emotional connection. And I don't think that I'm not saying that every artist does not have people who connect with them emotionally. But what I am saying is I think why this is my superpower is that I am able to actually convey emotion orally. Like, I think if emotion were a thing, I don't know how to say that. I think my superpower is the ability to truly convey emotion through music in a way that people see themselves in it and they see less me and more them, is what I think. Because I hear people all the time like, how do you do that? Like, you say the things I want to say. And I do that because it's emotion and not like a thought.
Corinne Bailey Ray, it's really interesting to talk with somebody who's really, really intelligent about music, about her music. It definitely seems like she's listened to Billie Holiday.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love her, and I didn't discover her till I was a teenager. There was one of those adverts on TV. You might not have had them in America, but we had this thing where you could go to the post office, you know, and then you got like a binder, and it was jazz great. So the first one was Billie Holiday, and that was the cheapest because it was the first one, and that was like, I don't know, $1.99. And you know, my family, we didn't have. And that's when we were growing up, the three of us, we didn't really have spare money, you know, because it was three girls. And so the fact that it was this singer and it was cheap and I could just go up the street and get it, I was just like, mom, I've just heard of this singer. And my mom was like, I love Billie Holiday. And I have seen this film with Diana Ross where she's played by Billie Holiday. And I was like, well, we've never listened to Billie Holiday before, you know, we didn't have any of her records. So that it was really revolutionary to me of like, you can sing, but you can bend up to notes. I had always had to do that because I have never been able to just land like, here's my, like right in the middle of the target intonation. And so it was, I loved hearing it. But my first response was like, how come I didn't hear his voice when I was 7 or 8 or 10 or 12 or when it would have made me feel a different way about my own singing. So it's instantly, it made me feel a different way about the sound I could make. Because up until then, I would be listening to like Emotions by Mariah Carey and thinking, why? You know, it's like, I want to sound like that, but I can't get that sound to come out. I've got this texture around my voice that I just can't get rid of. So yeah, so hearing Billie Holiday was a big thing for me.
It's funny to hear you say that you sort of envied Mariah. I mean, Mariah is like an extraordinary athlete, but you're a real singer, like a real singer. And there's a lot of things that you can do with your voice. I don't think of your voice as like she's limited and she's getting by on like personality or, you know.
Oh, well, that's good. I mean, I guess everyone feels like funny about their own instrument or whatever. And I feel like I've definitely come into it, and on my best days when it's like I've slept, I'm rested, I don't have a cold, I feel when I get to sing it feels to me like flying. It's like an out-of-body experience. It's like I'm in front of the audience, but I'm not really there. I'm just in my total element, you know, and then when the song finishes or the people clap, I am always kind of like sort of shaken out of it, because on a really good show, where I guess the audience is really with us and I feel like I can do what I love to do, then it does really click in. You know, I feel like I'm not a natural performer. Like I'm not the sort of person that goes to a party and it's like, right, everyone, I'm here. Let the fun commence. You know, like I'm the center of attention. I'm going to regale you with stories. And I don't really feel like I'm that person. So I feel like I can't turn it on is what I'm trying to say. And I've been at plenty of things now, you know, especially TV shows where it's like, here's your 2 minutes and 30 seconds, you know, and you're just like, ah, exactly. I just get terrified. But when I've got that, it's an hour and a half, and I get to walk on stage and you hear that applause and then you think, right, we're here. And you kind of like, I don't know, take the energy from that moment. Then I really feel like something just happens, you know, when the music comes together. And, you know, we always play live. We don't use backing tracks. We don't use click tracks. So I always feel it's just anything could happen. And that kind of focuses me in a way that I can't get in any other context, you know, even the studio. So
tell me about writing a song. How do you write a song?
How do I write a song? Most of the time when I write songs, well, I guess until recently, most of the time I've written songs, I'll have my guitar and I'll just be finding shapes, playing chords. And when I hit on some, and I'll be singing out at the same time. And sometimes one line will come out and I'll think, oh, I really like that. You know, I haven't planned it ahead. So it's like, it'll happen that I'll hit a certain chord and I'll sing a certain line with some words and a melody. And then I think, right, that's my fragment or whatever. Like that's my sort of golden piece. And then I'll just keep going and keep going. And then I might get like a little chain of those. And when I've got something that I feel is, it might be just like a bit of a verse or a bit of a chorus or a bit of a bridge. And then it's a case of trying other things to see if it fits or, you know, I have had things before, especially more harmonically simple things. There's something in my last record called a song called Walk On where it did all just come out in one go. Cause it's just literally, I'm playing two chords on the piano. I don't play the piano. So it's like, I'm just plonking my hands and remembering plonk it there and then put it here. But this thing's coming out more like a sort of stream of consciousness. And that's how I tend to write, just kind of letting things flood out. I guess there's other situations where I write with people and, you know, sometimes that's successful if I can feel comfortable and confident. And then there's other times where it's like the thing in me that comes out just kind of hides away, you know, and then it makes it difficult, you know, when it's like that. Yeah. And then more recently I've been writing this record where I'm sort of responding to these objects. So, and I didn't set out to do it, but I just saw, I was in this art space and I saw something. And then when I left, I realized that I was thinking about this thing was a pot, you know, so I was just thinking about this pot, you know.
Are you always open or is it like, okay, now I'm getting into album mode. Now I need to be like open to the universe and to inspiration.
I feel like I'm always open to it. I mean, if I'm on a really full on tour where it's just like, got to eat, got to sleep, got to get on this plane, got blah, 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 I'm less likely to be in the mode of like,
yeah,
I'm looking at leaves. But then sometimes even when you're, you know, a good long plane journey will do it, you know, where, especially before you had Wi-Fi on planes or whatever, it's just like, I'm tired, I've had a little sleep, I've had some food, and now my brain's just, you know, 10 more hours to go. I feel like your imagination just helps to entertain you. So sometimes I've got so many like voice notes of like, ah, you know, just like singing little, like things that when I go back to them, they don't make any sense. But at the time, on the way to Japan, like 7 hours into the flight, I just have to get it down. It's like mostly background noise, but then something in there, like some melody that I'm like, yeah, I need to do something with this.
But so, you're in album mode now, right?
Yes, I'm in album mode now. I mean, I'm quite far into this record that I'm writing. I guess I'm closer to finishing it, I guess.
Wow. But, How many songs are done?
It always takes me a long time to make records because I write them and because I'm producing as well. And it's always a bit of a sore point, I guess, with people that I work with, but I really like making music. To me, that's a massive fun part of it. Like, you've written the song, but you think, well, is this bit going to be strings, or is this bit going to be synths, or is this bit going to be a choir, or is this bit going to be just me and we're dropping out the drums, or is it going to be this amazing drum I know, or are we going to program it, or are we going to have horns, or is it going to be guitar takes, and then how many guitar takes we're going to do, and then is it going to be crazy delays, or how are we going to make, is it going to be a stark, or is it going to be like weird reverb world? Like, all of those questions to me are fascinating and fun, and I like to play and I like to get it wrong. And, you know, I've definitely made stuff where I feel like I haven't got it right, you know, and maybe someone else would have done a better job of producing it. But at the same time, that to me that's so much of the fun of it. And I have tried it the other way around. And, you know, especially being on a labor, it's like, this person is, you know, it's like that Zoolander thing where it's like, this person is so hot right now. You know, if you work with X, everything's going to be, you know, so, and frequently I feel bad for that person, but whoever X is busy. The person whoever is X at that time is so busy that even if they just loved you and they were like, I really want to produce your record. You know, I've been in situations with people like who are literally like the hottest thing on the planet. It's like, right, let's write a song together. And okay, so they're in the studio. They may or may not be several hours late. And then when you get there, it's like, right, let's work on this. And then like maybe 45 minutes into it, they're like, okay, when you get some ideas, you tell Jeff, okay, Jeff's going to record them. And I'm going to be down the hall because I've got another artist in this studio and I'm going to be working with them. But then when you get your thing and you're just like, the thing that's in me that can create just hides away at that moment. It's not even like, I feel offended. I just feel like, I just don't know how to do it like that. You know, I just don't know how to do it like that. So I have had a few run-ins with people who are just like, in the white heat of success, and trying to mesh with them is so hard, and just it just always just seems to go wrong for me. So
thank you so much to listening to this special episode. Torre Show, of course, gives you fuel to power your dreams, because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality. Maybe this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Torre and on Instagram at Torre Show. Torre Show is written by me, Torre, and produced by Jennifer Ford. Our editors, Ryan Woodhull. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shanta Covington and Nick Karp. And our booker is Claudia Jean. And we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we will be back on Wednesday with more amazing guests, because the man can't shut us down.